Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. Have you ever heard the history of your tribe told to you by a tribal elder, or perhaps maybe even your own parents? Do you consider this to be the real authentic truth of your tribe? Many would argue the events told in the oral histories of our people are as valid as any other account of history, especially when it comes to major moments in time that have changed tribal lives. Why don't more historians crack into the oral stories to help shape the world's history? We invite you to join the discussion as we talk about validating our tribal oral histories next on Native America Calling, right after National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Reno Sparks Indian Colony held a ribbon-cutting ceremony this week for a new super Walmart that tribal officials say will create jobs and help the economy. Willie Albright reports from Reno, Nevada.
The 180,000 square foot store opened with a traditional Paiute blessing to mark the beginning of a new era for the tribe, which depended on five smoke shops for most of its income. Arlen Melendez is the chairman of the Reno Sparks Indian Colony. He says income from tobacco has been on the decline lately, and that revenue from the Walmart will go to local schools, colony members, and to pay debts. Those include a $15 million bond used to build a tribal health center.
I think it was a great day in the tribe actually fulfilling our vision and, you know, participating in the American dream of self-sufficiency and then creating the partnerships along the way. So I think it's been a great day for us.
The store was built on 19 acres of blighted tribal land in the center of Reno. Melendez says not only does it create jobs for the tribe, it's also a source of pride. The store is decorated with tribal cultural symbols, and nearby highway interchanges will also be decorated with Native American symbols. For National Native News, I'm Willie Albright in Reno, Nevada.
For the second time in 2 years, the Havasupai tribe in northern Arizona has had to close its reservation to tourists because of flash flooding. Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker reports.
The Havasupai Reservation in northern Arizona is world famous for its turquoise waterfalls and steep red rock canyons. Every year, thousands of tourists make the 8-mile hike in or fly in by helicopter. But this month, heavy rains washed out trails and campgrounds and even damaged the waterfalls themselves. Billy Jack manages the Havasupai tribe's tourism department.
The falls have sustained so much throughout the years, so I think it's going to need a lot of time for it to go, you know, go back to how it used to be. I mean, not how it used to be, but acquire a new look, I guess. I mean, right now you can tell the impact of the flood. It's still pretty, you know, raw.
The floods also wiped out foliage along the riverbed. Jack says crews are working to replant. They're also repairing the trail leading down from the canyon rim to the village of Supai. It's deja vu all over again for the Havasupai. 2 years ago, an even more devastating flash flood roared through Havasu Creek, completely altering the course of some of the waterfalls. That flood forced the tribe to close the reservation for nearly a year. Restoration work cost well over $1 million. Now Jack says they have to make some of those same repairs all over again.
It's kind of caused us to go back to square one, yeah. I mean, a lot of the work, you know, that was done to kind of reinforce the pools. So those were knocked out, you know, during this flood.
Still, there is a silver lining. Jack says they're entering the off-season anyway, so the closure's economic impact won't be too devastating. They're hoping to reopen the reservation to tourists by November 1st. For National Native News, I'm Daniel Crocker in Flagstaff, Arizona.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Office of Justice Services will conduct tribal consultation on the Tribal Law and Order Act. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Larry Echohawk announced Thursday meetings will be held in October in California, Montana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Minnesota, and Florida. Provisions in the Tribal Law and Order Act include providing tribes with the opportunity to exercise enhanced sentencing authority, requires the BIA and OJS to collect and report data to Congress on public safety in Indian Country, and directs the BIA to establish policies, procedures, and guidelines in consultation with tribes. President Obama signed the act into law in July. During this week in 1869, Métis people created the National Council of the Métis. The group was charged with representing the Métis in negotiations with the Canadian government. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. With funding by the Washington, D.C., Albuquerque, and Alaska law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Anderson, Miller, and Munson. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is the Friday, October 15th edition of Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, sitting in for Harlan Makasato. Our oral traditions have sustained many generations. They speak of occurrences, the nuts and bolts of how things came to be, as well as what happened during important times in tribal life. They are also filled with accounts of how to use and love the land and how we as Native people walked on this land. Indeed, our oral histories are rich with the stories of who we are. But what about when it comes to sharing what is told through the generations as a valid history in terms of the world's history? Just how are our oral histories regarded when it comes to scholarship, governmental documentation, and I guess among those in the field of history who are often considered the bricklayers of the official historical documentation? And let me ask you this. Is what has been handed down through the oral tradition about the tides of the times as valid as any other account of history, especially when it comes to major moments that have affected our Native people? Does this account of history hold more authenticity for you, the truth of your tribe? And just how do you feel when it is challenged or dismissed as invalid, distorted, or something to file under folklore? Many would argue that the events told in our oral histories of our people are as strong as what you find in the history books and are even closer to an accurate account of what has happened in the past. And when it comes to your own tribe, do you believe that there is information that is only obtainable in these oral histories? If so, why don't more historians crack into these stories to get the first-person account on history? Do you think if the tribal accounts that are nestled in our own oral histories were shared, the world would be a different place? We invite you to join the discussion as we talk about validating our tribal oral histories. Our phone lines are open. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848, and that's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And also with this, you know, with the ongoing battle to keep our tribal languages alive, how are our oral histories affected as well? Again, the number is 1-800-996-2848. And I'd like to go ahead and introduce our guest. Joining us from his office in Bemidji, Minnesota, is Anton Troyer, and he is the author of the recent release, The Assassination of Hole in the Day, as well as Living Our Language and Ojibwe in Minnesota. And he currently works as a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. And he is also the editor of Oshkabewis, the only academic journal of the Ojibwe language. And Anton has received prestigious awards and fellowships from several organizations, including the American Philosophical Society, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Institute for the Study of World Politics, to name a few. And Anton is a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Anton.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you here talking about our history. And, you know, I just wanted to start off with that. You know, what does the oral history of your people, the Ojibwe people, mean to you?
Well, to me personally, our oral history is at the heart of who we are as a people. It's very much connected to identity, culture. It's connected very much to our language. And I'm sure it's the same for all tribes, that accessing oral history by its very nature requires speaking to the oldest and smartest members of our tribes. So it validates and reinforces cultural concepts for all Native people. Also, you know, I've often, I'm sure as many people have been frustrated with the discipline of history. You know, they have that mantra that the winners write the history books. And although we could take issue with that statement in general, it is true that a lot of our people have not been put in positions of power to write history and explain history to the rest of the world. And no wonder, you know, the few places that Native people pop up in the curriculum, you know, Christopher Columbus or Thanksgiving, for example, are sugar-coated versions of a really troubling past. And when we get into oral history, we get at true, authentic Indian voices. You can show very easily Indian agency, what's unique in our worldview, and oftentimes come up with information that would be entirely unavailable in any other form.
And what about that resistance that, or the argument that these oral histories are distorted?
I've heard that argument. I actually had to, you know, go to war with my discipline when I was a graduate student in the Department of History, and I had a couple of experiences. One was for the language requirement at the University of Minnesota. Historians had to work with two languages other than English. And, you know, if somebody wanted to study German history, they had to learn, you know, German, French, and English because there were primary source documents in those languages. I wanted to study Native history, and it was suggested to me that I study English, Spanish, and French. And I was just flabbergasted. I said, how can we get at, you know, Native thoughts about their own history if we're only looking at things written by Europeans in European languages? So I had to fight that, and to the credit of the, you know, my advisors at the University of Minnesota, I was able to use, excuse me, indigenous languages in my research and for the language requirement. But in many places, that's a hurdle that's, you know, difficult to overcome. So that's one, you know, dimension of, you know, resistance that we see. And I actually had another professor one time tell me that I shouldn't even be studying Indian history at all, because I was too close to the subject matter as a Native person. And this is coming from a white man who wrote 20 books about white people. So I told him that. I said, well, if I'm too close to Native history, then you must be too close to non-Native history. And then he started scratching his head. And, you know, I hope it helped him think a little differently about perspective and objectivity. The other major criticism of oral history is this, you know, assumption that if you whisper something in someone's ear and they to someone else and they to someone else, after several transmissions, the information is so distorted that there's no validity to it whatsoever. And that's often used to dismiss oral history. But my experience in the many applications of oral history is that that's simply not true. There are many types of oral histories. You know, they range from legends to, you know, reminiscences about particular events, you know, to stories passed on through time, all kinds of things. And, you know, for example, in writing the Assassination of Hole in the Day book, you know, we knew that in 1862 there was a major altercation in Minnesota. There was a conflict between the United States government and the Dakota Indians. There was also a brewing conflict between the Ojibwe and the United States government. And when that happened, there was a large group of warriors that came from Mille Lacs, surrounded Fort Ripley, and faced out to protect it from other would-be Ojibwe attackers. Now, we know that from the archival record, what the you know, Fort Chaplain was writing in his journals and things like that. What we did not know is why they did it. So the archival record could only say so much. When I was doing research, I was talking to an elder from Mille Lacs named Melvin Eagle. And he said, I'll tell you why they did it. That was my grandfather that went over there. And Niganiguaneb, who is the head warrior from Mille Lacs, they went over there, and this is why they did it. And so all of a sudden, the oral record was filling out information that was entirely unavailable anywhere else. And this wasn't somebody, like, you know, whispering in someone's ear. This was a, you know, a direct reminiscence. And there are many other cases where that happens too. You know, the further you go back in time, you know, the more transmissions of information you get. But there's a lot of history that's, you know, directly available from our people today. And even the ancient material is not so distorted as one might think, especially when you have, you know, traditional stories, legends, or formal histories. They're not told by whispering in someone's ear. I know when we, you know, tell certain types of stories, they're done in group. There is an expected version, and if someone deviates or forgets something, then they're prompted and corrected, and the stories are told over and over and over again so that, you know, at over 100 tellings, a couple of minor errors don't turn into major distortions. So to me, that's really not a valid criticism of oral history.
And often these stories are told in large groupings of people, so you have other people to correct you when you're kind of forgetting details. You know, that kind of leads to talking about the importance of memory and telling these stories to future generations. And you know, what role or how important is it that keeping these memories of things that have gone on in our tribal histories alive and giving that responsibility to make sure that these stories are told correctly, as you were saying?
You know, I think it's critically important. And, you know, of course, our oral histories and oral literature is vast. You know, there are so many different types of stories, not to mention numbers of stories themselves. But to me, you know, some of the really critical dimensions to the use of oral history are, number one, it shows agency on the part of Indian people. You know, there's this assumption that, you know, the white man showed up and the Indian went downhill, and that we were passive players in our own history. That, of course, is not true. But when accessing oral history from tribal elders, it becomes very clear that Native people were the actors and agents of, you know, not only resistance, but cultural change and everything else that has happened. You know, just to give you one short example of that, you know, in the Ojibwe culture, clan is a really important cultural concept. And I know this is the same for many other tribes, although there are varying customs about whether you inherit your mother's or father's clan and the types of clans and the various, you know, protocol or taboos around them or around marriage and so forth. But in any event, in Ojibwe culture, there are currently around 20 clans or so, and there's very little written or researched on clans. And so what happens is the few things that are out there say that there were either 5 or 7 original clans, and that clan determined your position in society. So chiefs could only come from the Loon clan and the Crane clan. And that's pretty much all that is said in the written textualized material that's out there. But if you take a look at, you know, the webpage for the Red Lake Ojibwe Nation, and see their flag, or if you notice it at a, you know, a powwow or something like that, printed on the flag are 7 clans. And those are the original clans that were at Red Lake when they were designing their flag. But on that flag, there is no Loon clan and there is no Crane clan, the so-called traditional leadership clans. But they most certainly had chiefs. And what happened is, you know, in doing oral history, speaking to Eugene Stilday or Tom Stilday or Anna Gibbs up at Panema on the Red Lake Reservation, they said, well, of course there's no Loon or Crane clan on there. You know, most of our people were warriors, and we had conflict with other tribes, and clans like the Bear clan tended to dominate our population in this region, and those were the clans that were picked to be chiefs in our community. And so you can see cultural change. This was ongoing before contact with Europeans, but it's Indians who are doing it. So instead of being kind of passively pushed around by non-native people, it shows that we were the ones who were affecting and making our own history. And, you know, all cultures change over time, including native cultures. And it's important to remember that not all changes are bad. Some changes can be good. Some are just benign, but understanding them really requires looking at, you know, our oral history and our language.
Okay. I want to open up the phone lines here. If you just tuned in, today we are visiting with the author and also Ojibwe professor Anton Troyer from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and we are talking about our oral histories and asking the question, how do they play into the world's history? What are your thoughts? What importance does the oral history of your tribe and maybe even your family play in your daily life? The phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And I'd like to bring in our first caller. We have Mario in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to us on KUNM. Welcome to Native America Calling, Mario.
Thank you. I'd just like to add my perspective on this. I'm a recent college graduate, and I studied textuality and orality. So textuality is the written word, and orality is, you know, oral history. And then in the paper I wrote, which is filled with a bunch of gobbledygook about deconstructionism and post-structuralism and, you know, these theories about knowledge and about data, about information. And the conclusion I came up to was that the stories contain the most, probably one of the most important discoveries of humankind. If you think about world history, if you think about the number of plants that the people eat today, that the humans of all over the world eat, they're developed by indigenous peoples. So you see, ingrained in these stories is this scientific knowledge. So that's only in scientific terms. So, but the most important discovery, the most important technology that's been created is what Navajos would call the Anaraib Kekhojan. It's understanding the human experience. And just one little example is that when we listen, these are really sacred stories, and you can see that you can actually remember back in 900 AD. So, and ingrained in there is the understanding of how to overcome hegemony, how to overcome what United States is perpetuating against indigenous peoples, or what happens when one group starts to dominate another, and there's ways to get out of that.
Okay, Mario, it's Anton. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think your comments are really well taken. And it also raises another important issue that comes up in doing oral histories. You know, when histories are truly oral and they're passed on, you know, through the spoken word, something does change when they are textualized. And that's another realm of discussion. And there are some variances, you know, by tribe and region about what's okay to put down on paper and what is not. I know I ran into these issues in researching the assassination of Hole in the Day and other things, and for the most part, I left it up to the people who were older and smarter than me to make those kind of determinations. But I agree that there is incredible amounts of information embedded in our oral histories about science, about medicine, observations of the natural world. Many, many stories abound about place. Not just why a place is sacred, but what's unique about its geographic features. Like right here, I'm looking out the window at what we call Bemidjigamog, or Lake Bemidji. And built into that word and the stories around it is a description of the unique geographic features here. The Mississippi River flows into the lake, and it immediately flows out, you know, less than a mile down the shore, and instead of flowing through the entire spans of the lake. So the word Bemidjigamog means the place where the current cuts across. And that's because we're in the middle of three major continental divides, and waters actually flow from here north, south, and kind of northeast. And so all three of those watersheds are pulling at the river right there. So we're at the northernmost point of the Mississippi River. It starts flowing north, turns east, and then goes south. And that all happens right here. It's built into that one word for a name. And it's built into the stories about the place. And it would be really hard to access that just looking at, you know, what non-Native people wrote about what was so special about this place and their observations of its beauty that don't really describe anything of the deep indigenous knowledge of the water, the place, the stories about, you know, everything in the natural world here, including medicines. So I thought Mario's comments are really right on. And returning to that subject of what gets textualized and what doesn't, I pretty much have left it up to the people I've worked with to make those kind of determinations. For Ojibwe stuff, we really don't textualize ceremonial texts. Those are given in their appropriate ceremonial context. And the reason is if something's written down, then someone can kind of try to learn information without going through ceremony, walk around their elders, and just pick up a book. So there's some things that we haven't written down, but almost everything else has been fair game from every elder I've spoken to, stories about place, stories about, you know, events in history, and really from ancient times up to the present. There's just such a wealth of information. I've been continually amazed by how much information we still have. And another point I'd like to make is that, you know, I often hear people talking about what we've lost or what we're losing, but to me, I'm amazed by how much we have. And our ancestors paid very dearly to keep our languages, traditions, and oral histories alive. And it's an incredible treasure, and we need to do everything we can, you know, to preserve and revitalize these traditions.
Okay. Well, Mario, we appreciate your call here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KUNM. And the phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And, you know, asking that question, has your tribal history been shared to you through either your elders or passed down in community settings? And what are those histories? And when you do know those histories, how does that change what you know about your tribe? And how does that compare to the stories outside of our Native communities that have been told about our tribes? The phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. And I guess also in terms of our tribal languages, you know, what's at risk? Often you hear the phrase that our tribal languages are at risk of going away. Many in the field of language revitalization will say, well, they're still here and we're keeping them alive. But when we think about these times as being dire times with our language, you know, what about those histories that are being passed down orally? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And on the line with us, we have Anton Truer and recent release, a new book, The Assassination of Hole in the Day and Accessing Oral Histories to Fill in the Blanks. You know, what do you think about that? Our phone lines are open. Give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. We'll be right back. Instead of waiting to receive honors from those outside the Native community, one organization is gearing up to articulate their own gratitude for Natives with an inspiring vision. When it comes to honoring those that have inspired our circle, who comes to mind and why? Join us as we talk about honoring our own visionaries on the next Native America Calling.
Nayangamk Duyology, Donlin Creek, LLC, Mc Reading is good for the mind, and it makes you smart. I enjoy reading Eskimo stories from my culture. I like to think about writing my own book and becoming an illustrator. The best thing about learning to read is that everybody will be proud of you. Kuyunakbuk. This message is brought to you by Reading is Fundamental, with funding from Macy's. Learn more at rif.org.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs Office of Justice Services has an immediate need to hire correctional officers, police officers, criminal investigators, and telecommunications operators to serve and protect in Indian Country. Join the ranks of federal law officers with a great salary, benefits, and a possible recruitment bonus. Candidates with prior or current law enforcement experience will be given priority consideration. Those with current state certifications may be considered for a 2.5-week bridge certification to get you up and on the force immediately. To find out more, go to www.usajobs.com or call 405-247-1541. The BIA is an Indian preference and equal opportunity employer.
Every year, people across the country lose thousands of dollars to fraudulent lottery and sweepstakes. If anyone tells you that you won a lottery or sweepstakes and asks you to pay for taxes or any other fees before you can get your money, it is a scam. Most of these frauds ask you to send money by wire transfer. Don't do it. Chances are you have not won anything and the money you send will be lost forever.
This message is brought to you by the Consumer Protection Unit of the Alaska Office of the Attorney General.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and I'd like to take a moment to say hello to a few of our affiliate stations like KABU in Fort Totten, North Dakota, KIDE in Hoopa, California, KOHN in Sells, Arizona, and hello to our listeners joining us on the internet on NV1 Native Voice 1, and also those of you tuned in to My Tribe TV. Today we are talking about validating our tribal oral histories and, you know, asking that question of, you know, what importance do the stories, do the histories of our people told to us by our own people mean to us? And when these stories, or I guess accounts of histories, are shared with us with people that we know or are from generations, and you know you're hearing directly from a great-grandfather, great-grandmother, and their account of history, you know, how does that change the importance of these stories? Our phone lines are open. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And I'd like to welcome back our guest. Joining us from his office in Bemidji, Minnesota, is Anton Troyer, and he is the author of the recent release, The Assassination of Hole in the Day. And he's also a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University, and he is involved in the revitalization of the language efforts and also keeping traditional ways alive. And he is a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Anton.
Great to be here.
And before the break, we were talking and wanted to ask that question. You know, you mentioned that you would refer to folks in the community to get more on the story of the leader, Hole in the Day. You know, how did you know it was time to kind of check something out with somebody and their oral history? Or were there clues or missing parts in the available documentation of him?
Well, I guess I have felt, you know, since I became an adult, that it's been high time for oral histories to be woven into, to general history books, since the first book was written on Indians. And I've always been amazed that there's been so little of that incorporated. I think there are a number of challenges for us. You know, it was really the civil rights movement that brought the mainstream of America into greater awareness of issues of race and, you know, economic struggle for Black Americans. And since that time, you know, there are millions of black Americans who've been able to, you know, ascend in academia. Our president of the United States, of course, is an obvious example of someone ascending to a position of power. And as of the result of numerous black voices that are writing books and challenging prevailing assumptions, that narrative is slowly changing. But for Native people, we have far fewer people, especially far fewer people with, you know, kind of credentials that matter to non-Natives, who are in positions of power to write books and, you know, make arguments that, you know, the historical community will listen to about the importance of oral history and tribal narratives and things like that. So we're really, you know, behind many other racial and ethnic groups in the United States in terms of being advocates for ourselves. As a result, you know, the people who have been writing a lot of our history books are not Native. And even those with the best of intentions oftentimes have a hard time accessing oral history, kind of penetrating a Native community, you know, and those who have usually left the Indians as nameless informants you know, kind of seized upon an opportunity to present themselves as authorities. And I think, the beauty of really working with oral history is that it's a little bit self-deprecating, because you have to say, I'm not the most knowledgeable person, but I spoke to many knowledgeable people, and here's what they said. So when I was researching the assassination of Hole in the Day, I wanted to do exactly that. I wanted to find out what was known. There's very little scholarship on things like clans, as I mentioned. There are major events in the history that were not widely reported on, or were reported on, you know, really from just one perspective, like we mentioned that event in 1862. But there were also, you know, huge dimensions to, you know, oral history that nobody had dared tap before. So, you know, I spoke to several of Hole in the Day's direct descendants today. They had some very interesting stories. Some of them included new information. They all included new perspectives on the chief and what he meant to Ojibwe people then and now. And all of that made the process and the end product in the book a lot richer. I ended up doing interviews with 50 different oral historians. Almost all of them were Ojibwe. The vast majority of the interviews were conducted in the Ojibwe language. But I also spoke to Dakota people. I spoke to some Potawatomi people, anyone who had knowledge that was relevant to the discussion, and tried to pull all those voices together. And some of the things that popped up were really surprising. Like, there's actually this this white banker from Brainerd who my father was speaking to, and confessed to going to Chief Hole in the Day's grave and digging it up to look for his chief medals. You know, just kind of really horrible action. But he had reported it in the course of the interview that he found the grave to be empty. There was no body there. And that raised a big question. Now, we just had more questions than answers, but I spoke to a number of the family members, and they said, of course, that gravesite was empty. The family moved him immediately after he was buried and brought him from Crow Wing up to White Earth and performed a traditional Native ceremony, and they had all this perspective. And regardless of you know, how you feel about talking to somebody who's now, you know, several generations removed from the time when that happened, by putting together, you know, the histories gathered from someone who had dug up the grave, to the family members, to, you know, the other circumstantial evidence in the archival record about, you know, surrounding his death and burial, it became clear that there was a lot more to that story than we ever knew or would have possibly encountered had we limited ourselves to traditional historical sources.
Well, yeah, clearly a great example of that. And I want to hear more about the folks that you visited to get these stories. But give out the phone number. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have some callers on the line. Let's go ahead and bring in Larry, who is up in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, on KILI Keeley Radio. Welcome to Native America Calling, Larry.
Thank you. How may Dr. Epi? Chantema washtena pech yuzapi. I wanted to comment on the oral histories and, you know, in particular, there is a great effort to really hide and bury our own traditional concepts. If you look at our tribal constitutions that were adopted in 1934, there's nothing cultural about them. You know, we have our own creation story, which really should be the basis of our constitution, which tells the world who we are, you know, where we came from, and this is how we are supposed to be living our lives. And because we don't have those things in place, then we also have misconceptions out there. You know, the culture itself was pretty much put underground for like 90 years. And then what came out at the end of that in 1976 was just the surface teachings. So right now we're kind of going through a cultural renaissance and having to really be diligent in our prayer and in our efforts to find the truth and the origin of where things came from, why we do the things that we do. So I wanted to kind of bring that to light. And I'm finding, you know, that a lot of the things that are in the history books, they take great credit for when it was actually the Indian people that really taught them how to survive and showed them different things. You know, even when it comes to things like plasma and vaccinations, all of that came from the prayer of the black man, you know. So I wanted to kind of bring these things to light and to let our own indigenous people know that when it comes to our culture, we were matriarchal in nature, which is where the non-Indians placed the passivity type of language or terminology with how we are. But in this matriarchal system that we have, there was no such thing as a chief. You know, it was the women who controlled the society, the women who were responsible for making sure that the laws were being strictly adhered to, and the men would go out and meet those. So we have misconceptions about these things, which also goes over into people say, well, I'm a warrior, you know, I'm a bad warrior and things like that, when it doesn't do justice to our culture. Because in our culture, humility is supposed to be in the forefront of our spirituality. And without that humility, you cannot obtain your warrior humble or your spiritual vision. And the spiritual vision was the main foundation of the person or the young man who became a head of household. And that's how he became known, was through his spiritual obtaining of his vision.
Okay. Well, Larry, we appreciate your call there in Pine Ridge, South Dakota on Keeley Radio. Anton, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Oh, just that I wholeheartedly agree with everything Larry just said. I find it critically important that we attempt to focus on the cultural dimensions of our lives when looking at oral histories or the construction of modern politics. And I have had many experiences, you know, in looking at oral histories that just provided a very different perspective. You know, I've done a lot of reading about kind of white feminist readings of looking at gender constructions in European cultures, and how when women were told, you know, given certain type of work, they were basically being told to stay barefoot pregnant and chained to the stove, and looked at power dynamics. But that lens doesn't apply in Indian communities. I know when looking at Ojibwe culture, where we have, you know, kind of gendered divisions of labor, there were certain things customarily that men and women did. It would be very easy to use a European lens or a European feminist lens to look at what's wrong there. But I was speaking to Mary Roberts, who's an elder from Manitoba, and I was asking, well, how come men are sitting on this side of the lodge and women are sitting on that side of the lodge? Isn't that a setup for, you know, women to be treated poorly or something? And she just laughed at me, and she said, no, my boy, That's a reminder that men and women each own half that lodge. So just an entirely different perspective. And again, if we don't use oral histories and empower our own elders and tribal elders and historians to tell the story, we are left with nothing but the, you know, intellectual and academic tools of Europeans. So no wonder, you know, the accomplishments of our race are so hard to find in something like a K-12 curriculum. At the same time, you know, I hear the comment about the importance of, you know, revisiting our political structures and constitutions and things like that, because for most tribes, you know, there isn't a lot of culture base to the construction of modern governments. They're just draft constitutions handed, you know, by the United States government, and they're based on a corporate governance model, which is why there aren't separations of powers and all kinds of problems in their construction. But there are some examples where tribes are trying to change that. I know at Red Lake in Minnesota, they know who all their traditional hereditary chiefs are, and all of them still attend the tribal council meetings, even though there's kind of a democratic construction to the government like there is in most tribes. All of those guys are there. They're all fluent speakers of the Ojibwe language, and they advise and consent or disagree with various policies and have a pretty big hand in government, even though it's not officially codified in their constitution. And I'm sure there's pressure in many different places to formally recognize older governance ideals and structures. I know White Earth has done a major constitutional reform effort, and I know there are discussions underway in many other communities to do exactly what Larry's been talking about.
Okay, well, let's bring in another caller. We have David in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KUNM. Welcome to Native America Calling. David?
Hi, Tara. Hi, Anton. See, it caught my attention when you were talking about perspective the respect to the professor at Bemidji State that was trying to instruct you, and you turned it around on him, and I appreciated that. I'm European, and I've run into that time and time again, even down here in Albuquerque. I grew up in Minnesota, but I'm in Albuquerque, and the European control of government here has kind of abducted my children, and I'm fighting them over that. And I see the same theme as a lack of looking at things from other than their own perspective, from the European point of view. And say, which professor was that you had that conversation with at Bemidji?
Oh, actually, that was a professor at the University of Minnesota. I don't know if I should name names on the air, but I think, at least to his credit, he was thinking a little differently after our conversation.
Yeah, I'd really like to know who that is. I graduated from the University of Minnesota, and I might know him.
Okay. Yeah, he might. Well, shoot me an email, and we can chat about it there. I'm easy to find on the Bemidji State University website.
Okay, David. Well, thanks for your call here in Albuquerque, New Mexico on KUNM. And, you know, we were talking about explaining the importance of knowing clans or even the representation of gender. And in your book, you know, one, if they're looking for the history of Hole in the Day and what happened and what were the events, often you open that book and you're ready to just start learning about the historical events or how things broke down. But in the book, you take a moment to explain, you know, clans or even just the history of the Ojibwe people. And why is it important to do things like that? I know as we're talking about this, about oral histories, that totally mirrors any time in our tribal communities when we talk about something. We start at the beginning and give that background because it is important to know all of that to just even understand one point of history. And just wanted to hear your thoughts on that, Anton.
Yeah, well, there were a couple of reasons for it. One is, you know, even though this is, you know, a modern historical book, you know, I wanted to be sensitive to traditional literary forms and narrative style. That was one thing. Another thing is, you know, for non-native readers, it's hard to assume that they have a lot of background information. Most people who go to school in the United States hear about Columbus and Thanksgiving, some sugar-coated version of those events, and that's their really only exposure to Native history. Most non-Native people do not understand, you know, the configurations of sovereignty or tribal law or major historical events, so some of that needs to be laid out. But also many of our own people also do not have a good background in our own history, our own stories and oral histories, our own cultural concepts around, you know, especially something like leadership, where, you know, our leadership patterns and structures have been so assaulted for so many decades, and they're not something that are taught in most schools, although that's slowly changing. So it was important to lay out background information that would be useful to those who are trying to piece together their own historical narratives as part of a quest for strengthening, Native identity and deeper understandings of self. So I was trying to lay kind of a groundwork for people to follow, you know, the threads in the book in any of the directions that would help them to understand, you know, who was Hole in the Day, you know, the who done it and the why done it to his assassination, which is just an incredible story. And then I was really trying to show Native and non-Native people a different and better way to research and write history books about Indians. And I think that's probably one of the great great accomplishments of the work.
And you've also done work working with elders and getting oral histories of their own personal lives. You have another piece of work, Living Our Language, and where you visited with folks. But you were actually doing the interviews and having these conversations in the language. And, you know, how does that change things?
It changes them quite a bit. You know, one of the people in Living Our Language, Archie Mose, was really just one of my most, my most important teachers. And I've just been astounded at the pace of change that our people have gone through. But Archie Mose was born in 1901. He was in his 30s the first time he saw a white man, and the first time he saw a black man, and the first time he saw a car. And through the course of his life, his children were born in wigwams. They were raised in a wigwam village. And by the time I met him, he was already 90 years old and, you know, 1990, and he was sitting in a modern house with the television on watching WWF SmackDown and laughing his head off. And I was astounded at the pace of change. But at the same time, when we started talking, he could speak English kind of, sort of, but he wasn't entirely a monolingual Ojibwe speaker, but verging in that direction. I mean, I took him to the bank to deposit a check, and he couldn't really endorse that check. He just scribbled on the back, you know, and I was like, holy cow, this guy can't write. And at the same time, even though he'd never finished the second grade, he was the smartest and most knowledgeable person I ever spoke to. He simply functioned better in the tribal language. So when speaking to him in English, you know, he couldn't pronounce his R's. There's no R sound in Ojibwe. You know, and people would sometimes maybe dismiss him. But when he spoke in Ojibwe, he spoke with such strength and eloquence and deep knowledge, not only of language and cultural customs, because he officiated many types of ceremonies, but of deep knowledge of history. So he was a cousin of Hole in the Day. And he had a lot to say about the chief, and especially about the structure of Ojibwe leadership, other events in history, clans, and it just opened up a whole new world. And had I limited myself just to doing work in English, I think, you know, I wouldn't have gotten nearly so far.
And it also, I think, as you're saying that and talking about him, it also brings up current day histories. You know, when we think of our oral histories, you know, oftentimes we're thinking of generations back. But, you know, telling those stories of today and some of the folks that you did get to visit with, you know, telling that more modern story of boarding schools or the fight to keep language alive today, right, and telling those stories and even nestled in there, why we have the big drum and kind of how songs came to be. You know, what are your thoughts on tribes doing more of this, or maybe even supporting their own tribal histories, the oral histories?
I would encourage every single effort in that direction. You know, times have changed a lot, and although I would tell people to work with and follow the directions of their, you know, elders about what they want written down and what they don't, at the same time, I think we need to push to do more textualizations of oral histories, using this resource much more than we ever have before, and making things available and accessible to our own people in formats that have never before been available to us. So technology, books, all of this is really useful. You know, we've had issues with a third of our people being adopted and fostered out through no fault of their own, and through no fault of their own, those who went through residential boarding school systems and had the language beaten out of them. Many of our people have been denied access to their own oral histories. And I think it's critically important that we create open access to our own people, as long as it doesn't violate other, you know, cultural rules about what should and shouldn't be written. And I've certainly, you know, bent a lot of my efforts in this direction, always asking and never assuming, you know, if it was okay or not. And, you know, every elder that I've talked to, they've just been overwhelmingly supportive. They're like, turn on your tape recorder, you know, I've got something to say here. And, you know, Melvin Eagle, when I was talking to him, we had tapes then, we didn't have digital technology, but, you know, he'd fill up one side of the tape, I was flipping it over and, you know, pushing record again, he filled up the other side, he said, put in about five or six of those, I'll fill them all up, you know, and they all have so much to say. And I think oftentimes a lot of our elders have been told that everything they knew was so worthless, you know, that it wasn't of value to a white historian. It wasn't of value to the American government. You know, it wasn't important. And when you access your elders with an open mind and an open heart and your best effort, you know, they will respond with equal passion about the projects that you're working on. And they'll provide guidance and deep knowledge. And I've just been amazed at how much information is out there in the minds of Ojibwe people today. I know, like you were mentioning, it's not just ancient history, but more contemporary issues. You know, I was visiting with Joe Oganosh, and he, you know, showed me a grocery receipt for $24. And what had happened is his father went to collect his family's allotment on the reservation at White Earth, and the local grocery store clerk had taken a charge slip for $24 worth of groceries, went to the Indian agent, and got his entire 160-acre allotment in its place. And Joe Oganosh was showing me this as a symbol and reminder of the treachery of that event. And he blew my mind, too, when he said, we're not losing our language. Our language is losing us.
Very strong statement. Well, Anton Troyer, we appreciate you joining us here today. And real quick, a website so folks can access some of the information, or maybe an email.
Absolutely. If you go to the Bemidji State University website, my email address and faculty webpage are available. It's easy to find. You can go to the Minnesota Historical Society Press, and most of those books are available there. Amazon.com and anywhere good books are sold.
Good deal. Anton Troyer, thanks for joining us here today on Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and thanks to our staff here, as well as with National Native News, NV1, and Kawanic Broadcasts.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the McCune Charitable Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Visit us at NativeAmericaCalling.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.